Welcome to the audio digest of the American Journal of Psychiatry. This is Dr. Susan Schultz with highlights for May 2009. Please note that the full text of all articles may be viewed online at ajp.psychiatryonline.org, including all author affiliations and disclosures. This month will begin with a review of dynamic psychotherapy for borderline personality disorder. From there, we'll turn to a study of how both major depression and antidepressant treatment affect pregnancy and neonatal outcomes. A related editorial will discuss the risks and benefits of treating depression during pregnancy. Then we'll highlight research on delusions in the general population. A long-term study of an Australian birth cohort allowed the authors to examine the relationship of delusions at age 21 to psychopathology during childhood and adolescence. We'll conclude with two investigations into metabolic changes related to psychoactive medications. One examined the effect of second-generation antipsychotics on patients with Alzheimer's disease, and the other one focused on the risk of diabetes mellitus after long-term use of antidepressants. We'll begin with our treatment in psychiatry feature. This month, Glenn Gabbard and Marty Horowitz discuss insight, transference interpretation, and therapeutic change in the dynamic psychotherapy of borderline personality disorder. They use a hypothetical case vignette to demonstrate the process. Ms. A is a young woman with borderline personality disorder. She reported to her therapist that she had shouted at a clerk in a store because he wouldn't accept her credit card. She said she wouldn't have shouted except that the clerk was curt with her. The therapist inquired, "Was it a policy of the store not to accept credit cards, or was it a matter of not accepting your credit card?" The patient felt that the therapist was suggesting she'd overreacted, and she became furious. The therapist explained that he was just asking for information. The patient's irritation then escalated, and she screamed, "You're not interested in empathizing with my feeling of being humiliated, only in figuring out how I caused the whole incident." The therapist replied, "It seems to me that the same thing that happened in the store is happening here with me. You're attributing to me some malevolent intent that isn't at all where I'm coming from." In this situation, a transference interpretation can be experienced as a form of criticism and may arouse more anger of the kind it aims to address. On the other hand, the therapeutic relationship may be as important, if not more important, than interpretation of the transference. As the therapeutic alliance is increasingly well-defined, transference enactments will inevitably occur, and the juxtaposition of the two processes can then help clarify problematic ideas and feelings. Two forms of psychodynamic psychotherapy have demonstrated efficacy in randomized controlled trials for borderline personality disorder. These include mentalization-based therapy and transference-focused therapy. Mentalization-based therapy de-emphasizes transference interpretation because of a concern that it may destabilize borderline patients. In addition, there's concern that it could convey that the therapist does all the thinking. By focusing on the patient's current mental state, the patient is helped to develop a greater sense of self-agency and more introspective capacity. The therapy that focuses on transference views unintegrated anger as central to borderline psychopathology. Transference interpretation is designed to help the patient integrate anger as well as its associated object and self-representations. These then become whole object representations or configurations of role relationship models. Both treatments recognize that state control is important and is gained through clarifying, priming, and using a therapeutic alliance to help the patient increase the capacity for self-observation. All therapeutic approaches provide a conceptual framework that allows patients with borderline personality disorder to organize their internal chaos. Different patients respond to different therapeutic elements. A good enough therapeutic alliance is a key ingredient. The core is the patient's perception that he or she is being helped and is pursuing goals held in common with the therapist. One analysis indicated that therapeutic technique accounts for only 12 to 15% of outcomes. The therapeutic relationship is the best predictor of outcome, but judicious and well-timed transference interpretations may help counteract a patient's negative perception of the relationship. Timing and word choice are vital. In a process study of long-term dynamic therapy with borderline patients, transference interpretation had a greater impact on the therapeutic alliance, both positive and negative, than other interventions. It appears to be most effective when the road has been paved with a series of empathetic, validating, and supportive interventions. The road continues to other methods of facilitating change in core attitudes. The phases of therapy can be illustrated by charting the course of therapy with Ms. A. The first phase clarifies a pattern that's maladaptive. The therapist challenges the patient's acceptance of the pattern and clarifies that the challenge is in her long-range interest. The initial phase encourages the patient to see her distress as growing out of her perception of events. Ms. A might be asked what she imagined the clerk was thinking. This attempt to understand someone else's mind as holding different beliefs from those in the patient's mind is the essence of mentalizing. The therapist identifies the recurrent interpersonal attitude as recognizable to the patient intrapsychically as a state of mind. Ms. A might see herself as an aggrieved potential victim, while others are regarded as mean-spirited and potentially harmful. With trigger stimuli, this state can shift into an undermodulated rage. Once she can see this pattern, she may still feel unable to change the attitudes that produce the self-impairing states. The therapist helps her gradually identify an underlying role relationship model. The key here is recognition of these states so that when Ms. A experiences one, she can retain sufficient reasoning processes to prevent the rage. As this happens, she can become familiar with the chronic nature of her readiness to feel aggrieved through interpretations that link this model to childhood role relationships. In this way, the therapist can provide an explanatory statement that leads up to transference work without directly addressing the transference relationship. This observation is repeatedly contrasted with the reality of the growing therapeutic alliance. By challenging the patient to reappraise an interpersonal situation, the therapist is clarifying that her fantasy of being abused is a reenactment, not a reasonable response, to his supposed lack of empathy. Well-timed transference interpretations are likely to promote, rather than destabilize, the patient's sense of security and coherence because a solid therapeutic alliance has been forged earlier. The patient will still tend to repeat the maladaptive pattern, and the therapist emphasizes that she needs to be ready for a sense of grievance and needs to stay alert so she can detect pre-rage signals from herself and the trigger behaviors she expects from others. This will require preparation and practice. Now let's turn to our research articles. The first study is by Catherine Wisner and colleagues, who examined major depression and antidepressant treatment, impact on pregnancy and neonatal outcomes. It was a prospective observational study and examined pregnant women in 5 groups. 2 groups took selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. 1 group took SSRIs throughout pregnancy, and the other took them for no more than 2 trimesters. 2 additional groups had untreated depression, one continuously and the other for only part of pregnancy. The 5th group of pregnant women weren't exposed to either depression or SSRIs. The use of antidepressants was confirmed by measuring their serum levels. Outcomes were evaluated by reviewing delivery records and by examination of the newborns 2 weeks after delivery. The main outcome measures were maternal weight gain, pregnancy duration, peripartum events, infant birth weight, and minor physical anomalies. Delivery data were available for 238 women. Of the women treated with SSRIs, more than 2/3 took them throughout pregnancy. The majority of drug use was monotherapy, and the most common SSRIs were sertraline, fluoxetine, citalopram, or escitalopram. However, the numbers of women in each drug group were too low to allow comparisons by individual drug. In relation to the women who weren't exposed to either major depression or SSRIs during pregnancy, those in the exposure groups didn't differ significantly in the number of minor physical anomalies, infant birth weight, or maternal weight gain. However, the APGAR score at 5 minutes was significantly higher for infants exposed to SSRIs continuously than for unexposed infants. The rate of preterm birth for the women who weren't exposed to either SSRIs or depression was 6%. The rates were above 20% for both the group with continuous major depression and the group with continuous SSRI exposure. Those with partial treatment or partial depression did not differ from the unexposed group. The high rates of preterm birth for both conditions imply that women in the two groups share a factor related to preterm birth. The underlying depressive disorder and its sequelae may constitute a long-term disease risk factor independent of current symptom level. An alternative explanation is that factors independently related to depression and SSRI treatment during pregnancy are associated with preterm birth and that the effects are of the same order of magnitude. Partial exposure to SSRIs or depression was not associated with a higher rate of preterm birth. This suggests that disease management choices affect reproductive outcome. However, the authors emphasize that the data do not support partial SSRI treatment during pregnancy to reduce the risk of preterm birth. Barbara Perry adds another perspective in her editorial, Assessing Risk and Benefit, to treat or not to treat major depression during pregnancy with antidepressant medication. Whereas preterm birth was a short-term outcome in the Wisner study, treatment decisions can also have long-term medical and social consequences. Multiple studies have demonstrated that major depression during pregnancy may impair the neurocognitive and socio-emotional development of the child, predict sleep problems in infancy and toddlerhood, alter neuroendocrine function, and increase the risks of mental and medical disorders in the offspring later in life. Also, depression during pregnancy is a risk factor for postpartum depression, and women with postpartum depression are at increased risk for recurrent depressive illness. Both of these conditions may further impair the child's development. In a longitudinal study of the effects of maternal depression on offspring, cognitive and socio-emotional impairments were observed when the children were 5 years old. As adolescents, these offspring had higher rates of affective disorders. Mothers who developed postpartum depression were more likely to experience depression subsequently, which contributed to the development of depressive disorders in their offspring. Anxiety disorders were also elevated in the offspring exposed to maternal depression, regardless of subsequent depressive episodes in the mother. In another study, the children of depressed pregnant mothers were followed until nearly age 6. The child's IQ was affected adversely by the duration of the mother's depressive episodes after delivery. In addition, language achievement was diminished by a higher number of depressive episodes. In a 20-year study of the offspring of depressed parents, the risks for anxiety disorders, major depression, and substance dependence were 3 times higher in the offspring of depressed parents than in the offspring of non-depressed parents. Social impairment, medical problems, and mortality also were higher. The STAR-D study demonstrated that remission of maternal depression after 3 months of medication was associated with reductions in the children's diagnoses and symptoms. Continued depression in the mothers was associated with increased rates of disorders among the children. These risks must be weighed against the potential long-term effects of pharmacological treatment. In the study that assessed children up to 6 years, they had been exposed to tricyclic antidepressants or fluoxetine throughout fetal life. Neither type of antidepressant adversely affected the child's global IQ, language development, or behavior. Some studies have shown increased risks of neonatal syndrome for paroxetine and fluoxetine, but some more recent studies do not support these findings. As Wisner and colleagues emphasize, these results do not support a recommendation for partial SSRI treatment during pregnancy to reduce preterm birth. Investigators from the STAR-D child study observed that it was treatment of maternal depression until remission that was associated with decreased psychiatric symptoms and improved functioning in the offspring. In the interim, studies are needed of non-pharmacological treatments, for instance, psychotherapies and sleep and light treatments. Next, we'll highlight the longitudinal study by James Scott and colleagues. They found that psychopathology during childhood and adolescence predicts delusional-like experiences in adults. Subclinical psychotic-like experiences are much more prevalent than clinically defined psychotic disorders. And in recent years, there's been increasing interest in the idea that features of psychosis can be conceptualized along a continuum. The authors report on findings from a large Australian birth cohort study that included detailed assessments of psychopathology at ages 5 and 14. They evaluated delusional-like experiences in the most recent follow-up, which was designed to occur at age 21. The mean age was actually about 20, however, because the cohort was born over several years and the follow-up interviews were completed within a narrower time frame. The evaluation of psychopathology at age 5 used a shortened version of the child behavior checklist, which is completed by a parent. At age 14, two measures were used: the child behavior checklist completed by the mother, and the youth self-report, which is comparable to the checklist but is completed by the adolescent. For each assessment, the cohort was dichotomized into those whose scores were in the highest quartile and those with scores in the lower three quartiles combined. Delusions at age 21 were assessed with the Peters Delusional Inventory, which is based on the present state examination. Some of the questions are: do you ever feel as if you are possessed by someone or something else? Do you ever feel as if people seem to drop hints about you or say things with a double meaning? Do you ever feel as if all things in magazines or on TV were written especially for you? And have your thoughts ever been so vivid that you were worried that other people would hear them? The inventory was completed by approximately 3,600 members of the cohort at the 21-year assessment. Previous work showed that younger members of the cohort and females were significantly more likely to have higher scores on the inventory, so the analysis was adjusted for gender and age. When the scores were assessed as continuous variables, the scores for delusions at age 21 was significantly related to the child behavior checklist at age 5 and both of the assessments at age 14. When the scores were assessed as quartiles, there was only a trend-level association between the checklist score at age 5 and the score for delusions at age 21. However, participants whose scores were in the highest quartile of either measure at age 14 were significantly more likely to have delusion scores in the highest quartile at age 21. Both measures have subscales for internalizing and externalizing symptoms, and scores on both subscales were also associated with the score for delusions at age 21. Now we'll look at metabolic changes related to psychoactive medications. First is a study from the Clinical Antipsychotic Trials of Intervention Effectiveness, Alzheimer's Disease, which is referred to as KDAD. Ling Zheng and colleagues report metabolic changes associated with second-generation antipsychotic use in Alzheimer's disease patients. These drugs are associated with metabolic abnormalities in patients with schizophrenia, but the data come from younger or middle-aged adults, and antipsychotics are frequently used to treat neuropsychiatric symptoms in patients with Alzheimer's disease. Excessive weight, diabetes mellitus, and dyslipidemia are risk factors for both cardiovascular problems and Alzheimer's disease. In addition, second-generation antipsychotics have been associated with cerebrovascular adverse events and deaths in patients with dementia. KDAD compared the effectiveness of 3 second-generation antipsychotics and placebo for treating delusions and aggression in outpatients with Alzheimer's disease. In Phase 1, more than 400 patients were randomly assigned in a double-blind fashion to olanzapine, quetiapine, risperidone, or placebo. Patients doing well on their assigned treatment continued it throughout the trial. In Phase 2, patients who discontinued the first treatment were randomly assigned to a different antipsychotic or to the antidepressant citalopram. Patients who discontinued Phase 2 received randomly assigned open-label study medication that was not previously prescribed. A patient could also directly shift from any of the 3 phases to the open-choice phase to receive non-study medications of the physician's choice. Height, weight, blood pressure, and waist and hip circumference were measured at baseline and at each clinic visit during the 36-week trial. Body mass index and the waist-to-hip ratio were derived from these data. Blood pressure was measured once in a seated position at each visit. Blood samples were obtained at baseline and every 12 weeks after that. Measurements were made of serum glucose and plasma total cholesterol, triglycerides, and high-density and low-density lipoprotein cholesterol. The patients ranged in age from 51 to 103 years. The mean was 78. 56% were female. On average, the patients were overweight and had elevated systolic blood pressure. Almost half were using antihypertensive agents. 60% were taking anti-dementia medications, 24% were receiving cholesterol and triglyceride reducers, and 10% were taking medications to lower glucose levels. The change in weight during the study varied by gender. For women, but not for men, the weight gain was significantly greater among those taking antipsychotics than among those taking placebo. Also, the amount of weight gained was positively associated with the duration of antipsychotic use. Patients who took antipsychotics longer than 6 months were more than 3 times as likely as patients not exposed to antipsychotics to have a clinically significant increase in weight, which was defined as 7% or more. At baseline, none of the metabolic measures differed among the different medication groups. Compared to placebo, significant weekly weight gain was observed for olanzapine and quetiapine. In addition, olanzapine was significantly associated with increased waist circumference and decreased HDL cholesterol. No effects of antipsychotic treatment were noted for systolic and diastolic blood pressure, glucose, or triglycerides. The magnitude of the weight gain, increased in waist circumference, and change in HDL cholesterol among these patients with Alzheimer's disease is similar to that reported from a large trial in younger people with schizophrenia. However, at baseline, the Alzheimer's disease patients had substantially lower body mass index, narrower girths, and higher HDL cholesterol levels. The difference in weight changes between women and men doesn't appear to have been reported previously in Alzheimer's disease patients or the elderly. The women were older than the men and had a higher HDL cholesterol. Because elderly women proportionally have more fat mass and less lean body mass than elderly men, they may be more susceptible to weight gain associated with second-generation antipsychotics. The increasing difference in weight gain with continuing antipsychotic treatment is particularly concerning given the association of weight gain with both cerebrovascular disease morbidity and mortality. Both of these outcomes appear independently associated with antipsychotic use in dementia patients and are listed as warnings in the drug's labeling. Some patients in the current trial may have benefited clinically from antipsychotic use in terms of particular symptoms, such as anger, aggression, and paranoid ideas. On the other hand, they didn't benefit in activities of daily living, care needs, or quality of life. The risks of adverse events associated with longer-term use of second-generation antipsychotics must be carefully balanced against their benefits. In addition, patients receiving these drugs should be monitored closely. Metabolic changes were also the focus of Frank, Anderson, and colleagues. They examined long-term use of antidepressants for depressive disorders and the risk of diabetes mellitus. Several antidepressants have been reported to cause considerable weight gain and impairment of glucose homeostasis, but the data on the risk of diabetes are sparse. The authors examined a research database containing medical records for patients in general practices in the United Kingdom. They performed a nested case control study in a cohort of patients given at least one new prescription for an antidepressant during a 5-year period. Nearly 166,000 patients were included in the analysis. Cohort entry was defined as the date of the first prescription of an antidepressant. The patients included were at least 30 years old and had a diagnosis of depression. They had no diagnosis of diabetes or impaired glucose tolerance, no previous treatment with oral antidiabetics or insulin, and no treatment with antidepressants in the year before the index prescription. The patients were required to be older than 30 years to help ensure that incident cases of diabetes were most likely type 2, since it's not always possible to differentiate between type 1 and type 2 from the diagnostic codes. Each patient was followed up from cohort entry until the first date of any of the following: new onset of diabetes, a switch to or combination with another antidepressant, death, end of registration with the practice, or end of the study period. Case subjects were defined as those who had at least one prescription of an antidiabetic drug, two diagnoses of diabetes on different calendar days, or a diagnosis of diabetes and a diabetes-specific test on different calendar days. For each case, up to 4 comparison subjects were randomly selected. They were matched on age, sex, and year of cohort entry. Comparison subjects were followed up for the same amount of time as the case subjects with whom they were matched. The mean follow-up time was 2.8 years. Approximately 2,200 patients fulfilled the criteria for the case definition of diabetes. 60% of the case subjects had been exposed to an antidepressant within 2 years before diabetes onset. Of those, 850 had taken antidepressants in the preceding 6 months. Because only one case subject and one comparison subject were exposed to MAO inhibitors, this drug category was not further analyzed. A high body mass index at baseline was the strongest predictor of new onset diabetes. Patients who had used antidepressants for more than 2 years and had recently used them at moderate or high doses had an 84% higher risk of diabetes relative to non-users. Diabetes risk was not related to antidepressant use that had lasted less than 2 years, entailed lower doses, or ended 6 months or more before diabetes onset. For users of tricyclic antidepressants and SSRIs generally, increased risks were likewise observed only for recent long-term use of moderate or high daily doses. In the analysis of individual antidepressants, increased risk estimates were observed for the use of amitriptyline, fluvoxamine, paroxetine, and venlafaxine. This effect was again evident only in long-term users. The authors discuss possible mechanisms for the observed association. Weight gain is a common side effect in short and long-term treatment with tricyclic antidepressants. There are conflicting data about whether individual tricyclic antidepressants differ in the potential for causing weight gain. In this study, an increased risk of diabetes was observed only with long-term use of amitriptyline. Weight changes associated with SSRI treatment are complex. There is evidence for an initial stable weight or even weight loss with SSRIs, followed by weight gain if used for longer periods. Some studies have suggested differences in the potential of individual SSRIs to cause weight gain. Other mechanisms beyond weight gain may have a role. In the Diabetes Prevention Program trial, the increased risk of diabetes in the users of antidepressants remained significantly elevated even after adjustment for the observed increase in body weight. Thus, a role may be played by other mechanisms, such as hyperglycemic effects of noradrenergic activity of antidepressants. Another possible explanation is that depression itself, and not the antidepressant drug treatment, increases risk of diabetes. It has been reported that patients with depression have a 35% increase in risk of developing diabetes as compared with non-depressed individuals. The underlying reasons for this association are unknown. This concludes the audio highlights of the May issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. We invite you to our website, ajp.psychiatryonline.org, for the full text of these and other articles. We also welcome comments regarding this audio. They can be emailed to Jane Weaver. Her email address is jweaver@psych.org. Thank you.